we kind of left things dangling yesterday. We were noting that the action in the book of Revelation seems to be carried by the three series, the seals, the trumpets, and the vials. Now, what we have under the seals is a picture of a world ruined by men. As God steps aside, takes the church home, removes the restraints, hands the world over to men. In the space of one short chapter, the world is reduced to total chaos. A world ruined by men. What Jesus called in Matthew chapter 24 is an exact parallel, really, between those opening verses of Matthew 24 and what we have in Revelation chapter 6. Jesus called these things the beginning of sorrow. It's a world ruined by men. When you come to the trumpets, everything's escalated and you have a world ruled by Satan. The symbolism is very much more complicated when you come to the trumpet judgments. One of the things that confuses the picture is the way people jump around when they interpret the book of Revelation. I'll give you one example. If you read a verse with me this morning in chapter 9. Verse 13. And the third angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel, which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour, a day, a month, and a year, to slay a third part of men. And the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000,000. I heard the number of. Now that's 200 million. Now people automatically assume that that refers to China. There's not the slightest shred of biblical evidence that that refers to China. Just because the armies that are mobilized number this figure 200 million. People just assume that this refers to China. And I don't know how many times I've heard that from people. You probably heard it heaps of times as well. No mention here of the kings of the East. No mention at all of China in this context. And yes, this is what we're told, 200 million, that's got to be China. Now look at chapter 16. And verse 12. What you have in chapter 9 is the sixth trumpet. What you have in chapter 16, verse 12, is the sixth vial. Quite a different thing. Something altogether different. It's a different sequence of events. It's a different series. Not the trumpets now, that we've passed beyond those into the vials. Sixth trumpet is not the same as the sixth vial. Sixth trumpet mentions an army or armies numbering 200 million. No mention of the kings of the East, no mention of China, no mention of anybody. When you come to chapter 16, verse 12, and the sixth vial, it's quite a different thing. You read, the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates. Euphrates involved again. It's a totally different context. The water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the East might be prepared. and so on. It ends in verse 16 with reference to the Battle of Armageddon. So the kings of the East, this China and her associate Eastern powers, no doubt China in alliance with Japan, and India, Indonesia, all the countries east of the Euphrates. The traditional dividing line between East and West is the river Euphrates. When you come to the sixth vial, then you have China coming on to the picture. China doesn't come onto the stage until the Battle of Armageddon. What you have in chapter 9 isn't the Battle of Armageddon. A lot of things have to happen between the sixth trumpet and the sixth vial. But that's just a classic example of how careless people are in interpreting the book of Revelation. No wonder there's so much confusion about this particular book. We might well ask the question, well, what about this army of 200 million that's mentioned under the sixth trumpet? Where do these soldiers come from? Where are they mobilized? Who does this represent? What war is this? It's not Armageddon. Because Armageddon doesn't happen until you come to the end of the vials, the very last thing before Christ sets up his kingdom. What army is this? Where does this army come from? What battle does this refer to? Well, that's a very good question. I puzzled about it for a long time. I'd been brainwashed too ever since I was a little kid that this army, 200 million, had to do with China. And when I started a verse-by-verse exposition of the book of Revelation, came and found out that it fitted in here, not there. It really threw me for a long time, and I had to puzzle about it, pray about it, and go back into the Bible itself to see what this particular invasion could be. Well, there's only one other battle in the Bible that assumes anything like this dimension. And that's the battle that's mentioned by Ezekiel. It's when Russia mobilizes all her armed forces and comes down into the nation of Israel. That's the only other battle of anything like this size. If it's not the Battle of Armageddon, which it's obviously not, then what other battle can it possibly be? And it occurred to me that this particular battle here in the sixth trumpet, where you have these enormous armies being mobilized, doesn't say they all belong to the same country. It probably refers to the Russian invasion of Israel. And that shed a great deal of light upon my understanding of the apocalypse. One of the great problems in prophecy is to fit that Russian invasion into the book of Revelation. A lot of people have assumed that it's part of the Battle of Armageddon. Well, it's not part of the Battle of Armageddon at all, because I haven't time to spell out all the differences between the Russian invasion and Armageddon. I've spelled them out in the book Exploring the Future, but there are at least a dozen different differences. One of the most obvious is that in Ezekiel 38:39, Israel is dwelling in safety when the Russian invasion takes place. Whatever else you may say about the nation of Israel, it's sure hidden dwelling in safety at the time of the Battle of Armageddon. The Great Tribulation has been raging for 3.5 years. It's the most terrible time in Hebrew history. And if there's one thing you can say about the nation of Israel at the time of Armageddon, it certainly is not at peace and it's not dwelling in security. In fact, it's facing utter annihilation. So the Russian invasion can't have anything to do with the Battle of Armageddon. But here you have an invasion that fits. It mobilizes enormous armies. And it occurs at a critical juncture in the book of Revelation. And you put the Russian invasion, it explains a whole lot of other things. In the first place, the number 200 million does not have to be necessarily a literal number. Now, it could be, and of course that's one of the problems of interpreting the book of Revelation, because some things you can see them as being either symbolic or literal. And sometimes there's a blending of the both. But the number itself, while it could be a literal number, it's hard to conceive that when you've added up all the soldiers involved in this particular battle, it'll come out to exactly 200 million, period. It's obviously a round number. And it's probably a symbolic number. The number 200 is used in a very significant way in the Bible. I think you'll find it half a dozen times. The key to the significance of the number 200 is given to us very clearly in the Gospels. Remember when the Lord was going to feed the 5,000, and he thought he'd toss the problem to the disciples first, see what they'd do with it. And old Philip, you know, he does a bit of mental arithmetic. He says 200 penny worth of bread is not sufficient. 200. It's the number of insufficiency in the Bible. Now you go back with your concordance and look up every reference to the number 200 in the Bible, you'll see it's always connected with this concept of insufficiency. Now, Russia mobilizes all its armed might, and it's preparing day and night, every single day, has been ever since Second World War, for this particular invasion. It sees it as a strategic opportunity to knock the West completely out of the Middle East and grab the very vital hinge of all strategic power on this planet, place where three continents all come together. No power's ever been a world global superpower that hasn't controlled the Middle East. Britain had a world empire because she controlled the Middle East. Napoleon, in his campaigns in Egypt, realized the strategic significance of the Middle East. Russia comes down in here because she wants to control the land bridge between three continents and to control the world. But she's going to find that her armies are insufficient. Now what happens, it seems, is this. You have a world ruined by men under the trumpet. World is reduced to total chaos. Men are absolutely horrified at the anarchy that has taken over the planet. They are looking desperately for somebody, somewhere, anybody who can step on the stage of history and bring order out of this chaos. They're looking for a man. Anybody. The devil has that man standing in the shadows waiting. He steps on stage. The devil says, I've got just the man you need. He's the man of sin. He's the son of perdition. He's called the lawless one. We sometimes call him the Antichrist. although that's a rather nebulous expression, and theologians are quite antagonistic one with another as to whether the expression refers to the first beast or the second beast, and obviously can't refer to both of them. Well, we call him the Antichrist just for the sake of the name. So the devil produces his Messiah, and he steps on the stage of history. He unifies the nations of Western Europe, comes up out of the sea of nations, presumably out of one of the nations that border on the Mediterranean. We were thinking yesterday that he has three capital cities. The first is Rome, his political capital. He uses the Roman Catholic system to unify the West. And once he has unified the Western powers, has no more use for the Roman Catholic system. Revelation chapter 17, one of those parenthetical commentary sections, tells us what he does once he's used the scarlet woman. He tears her all to pieces, got no more use for her. Or the religion that she represents. He's got his own ideas about religion. They certainly don't coincide with anything that has to do with Christianity or Judaism or anything else. So having got rid of the scarlet woman, he now moves his sphere of interest from Rome to Jerusalem. He signs a pact with the nation of Israel. 7-year pact. That's when the prophetic clock really begins to tick again. The last week of Daniel now comes into its own. Rapture has long since taken place. We don't know the date of the rapture. Nobody knows that. That's a secret. We are given enough indication in the Bible. We can tell we've entered the time period, but we can't tell the date. It's going to be quite different with the Jews. Once the Antichrist signs the 7-year pact with the nation of Israel, it's only going to be 7 years to the end. When he breaks that pact halfway through, the Jews will be able to begin a countdown. 1260 days to the coming of Christ. 1221 days to the coming of Christ. 948 days. 302 days. 101 days, 64 days, 28 days, only 12 more days, only 3 more days. It's going to be tomorrow. 1260 days, 3.5 years, 42 months. A time, times, and half a time. All these different ways of telling us that you can count it right down to the day. Now, Jews will be able to do that because they'll know when it's going to start, they'll know when it's going to stop. The moment that image is set up in the temple, that's when the countdown begins. We can't do that for the rapture. Jews will be able to do it for the return. And what happens, it seems, is that the devil's Messiah, having unified the West, having all the tremendous industrial, economic, military potential of the West behind him, all unified now, all controlled by a super dictator, the whole thing harnessed and geared to his ambition, tutored by Satan, genius, knowing exactly where he's going. His objective is to rule the world. Daniel doesn't tell us that, but Revelation does. Revelation, the book of Revelation makes absolutely clear that the Antichrist, the beast, or whatever you want to call him, is going to rule for a very brief period the whole world. Now, there's a major obstacle in his way, and that's Russia. Russia stands astride all the power points of the world. The West is steadily backing up. Every year, Russia moves forward another step. As Britain abandoned all her key positions in the world, Russia's been steadily moving in. And here you have this giant colossus to the north, dominating not only the north, but much of Europe, concentrating heavily on the Middle East, controlling key countries in Africa. The beast wants to rule the world. He can't possibly rule the world as long as Russia is standing in the way. So somehow he's got to get rid of Russia. He does it by very simply signing a treaty with the nation of Israel. Under the cover of this treaty, he guarantees unconditionally the security of the nation of Israel. That's the only time after the rapture, that Israel will be at rest, when Israel will feel secure. For the first time since she became a nation, she will feel now that she doesn't have to worry about a war with her Arab neighbors. She doesn't even have to worry about Russian intrigues in the Middle East. She has the backing of the West, not a weak, divided West as we have today, but a West that's armed to the teeth, harnessing all its technology, all its industrial might, all its potential military power. To further the ambitions of the beast, signs a pact with Israel. He's tutored enough of Satan to know that when Russia invades Israel, God will wipe Russia off the map. So he signs a pact with the nation of Israel. It's really waving the red flag to the bull. It's baiting the bear. That's what he's doing. And he unconditionally guarantees the security of the nation of Israel. The Bible calls it an agreement with hell. Jews think they're being very clever. Having rejected the Christ, they now accept the Antichrist. Under the terms of their treaty with the beast, with the West, apparently, the Jews rebuild their temple. That, of course, involves getting rid of the Mosque of Omar. Now, you can just imagine what that will do to the Arab world. The Muslims absolutely infuriated to the point of insanity by this new move by the Jews to build their temple on the temple site. They'll appeal to Russia. Russia realizing that it's now or never, that this is her last and her final opportunity to become a global power. She'll feel those hooks that God's put in her jaws to pull her down into the land of Israel. And down she'll come, only to be wiped off the map. Now, there's no other place in the book of Revelation where it fits except right here. Armies numbering 200 million involved in this battle. whether a literal or a symbolic number, is quite immaterial. It just sets before us a picture of a conflict that just simply defies description. I mean, we can't even conceive what will happen if there is a final confrontation between the East, between the West and the North. The very thought of it frightens us, so that our statesmen, every time they think about it, they back up, and so far every time Russia thinks about it, she backs up. This time they don't back up, either of them. Of course, the beast knows perfectly well that the moment the Russian armies cross the frontiers of Israel, that something's going to happen to Russia. That's what he's counting on. And sure enough, that's what happens. This invasion takes place. It's very, very difficult to interpret these verses because the nature of the symbolism, we're no longer talking about things with which we're familiar. The symbolism is very much more complex because it's dealing with the world of the occult. Satan is behind all this. He wants to put his man on the throne of the world. He's not content that his man should be on the throne of the West. He's not content just with the revived Roman Empire. He wants to rule the world. That's always been Satan's ambition. The book of Revelation makes it quite clear that the whole world is going to be involved in beast worship. So Russia invades, and God acts. One day, the world turns on its newscasts and listens to the horrifying news that the Russians have mobilized, that they have moved their armies, and that they're moving rapidly southwards. They've picked up all their allies. Ethiopia's coming in from the south. Iran is coming in from the east. Russia's coming down from the north. The Western world is mobilizing. It looks as if the point in history that has frightened men ever since the Second World War is now about to take place. But before anything happens, God steps in. And one day the world wakes up to see the Russian armies moving across the frontiers into Israel. They turn on their news the next day, and Russia's no longer there. She has ceased to exist as a world global power. She's been utterly annihilated, wiped out by a disaster, by a holocaust, the like of which has never happened in all of history. Now you can imagine the geopolitical vacuum that'll be left in the world by the demise of Russia. That's just what the beast is waiting for. Before the rest of the world can recover from the shock, the beast simply takes over all Russia's former spheres of influence. His armies pour up through the Urals into the heartland of the Soviet Union. They take over all Russia's spheres of influence in the Middle East. They bring all Russia's interest in Africa into the Western sphere. The beast now controls not only the West, he controls the North, he controls the South, he controls the Center. He says to the nations of the Far East, join or else. And in that parenthetical passage in chapter 13 that tells us how it all happens, the nations are recorded as saying, who can make war with the beast? Who's like unto him? Now he rules the world. The whole world lies in the lap of the wicked one. It's what C.S. Lewis calls that hideous strength. There's no way out. At this point, the beast has no more use for the Jews. He's only used them. They've just been a pawn in a larger game. They are now expendable. And he begins the great tribulation. Takes over their temple, puts his image in the temple. False prophet harnesses world opinion. Men have to receive his mark. They have to worship his image. At this point, a rebuilt city appears upon the stage of history called Babylon. As Rome was his political capital, and Jerusalem now becomes his religious capital, the center of beast worship, so Babylon becomes his financial capital. It's amazing how the wealth of the world is moving back in that direction already. He just expropriates all the wealth of the Arabs. I says, that doesn't belong to you, that belongs to me. And he's got no more use for the Jew, and he begins the great tribulation. That's what you have under the trumpets, a world ruled by Satan. I haven't time to do any more this morning except just to mention that under the vials, you have a picture of a world rescued by God. Because that's not the last word, you see. And under the opening vials, the power structure of the beast is smashed to pieces by miracles of judgment that very much correspond with the miracles of Moses. And the beast finds that his power structure begins to disintegrate. The eastern half of his empire breaks away, mobilizes against him. And then the kings of the east come across the Euphrates. That's where China comes in, at the very end. The Battle of Armageddon is staged. Starts as a confrontation between East and West. It ends up as a confrontation between heaven and earth. Because there's an invasion from outer space. Jesus is coming again. The countdown is over. And Christ invades the planet, puts an end to man's mismanagement of his affairs. A world rescued by God. There's the broad, sweeping outline of the story. You find many of the details developed in those two books I mentioned, Exploring Revelation and Exploring the Future. It's about 40 or 50 pages in that book on Russia and her satellites, and a thorough discussion as to where this invasion actually takes place in the prophetic scheme of things. One of the things that's been particularly gratifying to me is that it's absolutely consistent. It's a consistent hermeneutic. You haven't had to strain anything to make it fit. And when you make it fit, explains a lot of other things. Explains how the beast controls the world. And it explains how Israel can be at rest and in security when it happens. Trust that these meditations have been helpful. If you don't agree with them, I'm awful sorry about that. That's your privilege. Shall we pray? Father, thank you for these great flashes of light from the sacred page that illumine so much that's happening in today's world. Truly, we don't have to be afraid of what's going to happen. Nothing can happen without your permission. God is still on the throne. And nothing can really happen apart from just further setting of the stage until the rapture takes place and we're caught home anyway out of it all, to be with thyself forever, to come back with you at the very end when it's all over, to witness the setting up of thy kingdom on earth. We would pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Lord, as we see day by day the whole plan moving forward, another state, another notch, like those ones around thy throne who cast their crowns before thee, we just worship you because you're not making any mistakes. You're in sole charge. Help us to look up as well as to look around, for our redemption draweth nigh. In Jesus' name. Amen.